one of the great dilemmas in investing. Sometimes they're right and sometimes you're right. You have to have superior insight. When I was preparing the most important thing for publication back in 2011, I believe it was, I had lunch with Charlie Munger, who worked in the building next door. And when I got up to go, he says to me, just remember, none of this is easy. And anybody who thinks it's easy is stupid.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us. My name is Emma Anderson, and I'm the Chief Executive Officer on Limestone Capital. Today, I'm joined by Devin Meng, our Chief Investment Officer, Armand Cherna, our Chief Strategy Officer, and Tian Li, who is a first-year student at Queen's University. Before we kick things off with intros and Q&A, I'll just give a very brief introduction on Limestone Capital, who we are, and what we do. So Limestone Capital is a student-run asset management organization at Queen's University. We manage three long-only equity portfolios, investing in small to mid-cap Canadian and U.S. equities. We're a team of roughly 35 students who operate within six different sector teams and employ a value-based investing approach. With that, I'll pass it off to my colleague, Devin, to kick us off with the event.
Thank you, Emma. And thank you to everyone for taking the time to join us in this very special fireside chat today. Today, we are incredibly honored and fortunate to be joined by one of my personal investing idols, Howard Marks. For some background, Howard earns his bachelor's degree from the Wharton School and then subsequently received his MBA from the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business. Upon graduation, Howard joined the Citibank as an equity research analyst and then eventually landed within the bank's pioneering convertible and high yield debt division. Howard then went on to join TCW in 1985, and in 1988, Howard and Bruce Karsh, one of Oaktree's other co-founders, went on to set up one of the world's first distressed debt funds. And then in 1995, Howard left TCW to start Oaktree Capital Management and has since then grown the fund to be one of the world's largest and most successful alternative asset managers, with currently around $170 billion in assets under management and 19 offices around the world. Howard, thank you very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be with you today, Devin.
So just to kick things off, I really wanted to first discuss a bit more about your career. Throughout your career, you've had many instrumental moments, one being you leaving TCW to start Oaktree in 1995, and another being in the fall of 2008, where you put around $500 million into distressed debt every single week. What would you say was the most critical or most defining moment of your career so far?
Well, there are so many, it's hard to pick. Obviously, when I shifted from equities at Citibank to convertibles and high yield in 1978, that was the beginning of the high yield era. So that was a great time to get online. I don't know if you've read the book, Malcolm Gladwell's book, The Outliers, but he talks about demographic luck, right time, right place. You know, the kind of the subtitle of that book could be The Benefits of Being First in Line. And so I was toward the front of the line on high yield bonds, and that was very advantageous. Then, as you described, Bruce and I started a distressed debt in a fund in 88. I think we were at the very front of the line then, and that's been a great place to be. Being joined by Bruce in 87 clearly turned my career around, because we complement each other so well and work together so well, and he's such a genius neither of us would be where we are without the other, I think. And then, of course, you know, when you went through the meltdown of the tech bubble in 2000, the stock market was down in 2001 and 02, the first 3 year decline since 1939. And the Fed took, so people lost interest in the stock market. And then the Fed took rates very low to solve the problem of the economy. And that made bonds very uninteresting. So most people concluded that they couldn't get the returns they needed from stocks and bonds, and they had to go into alternatives. And of course, alternatives is what Oaktree did. And so that did great things for our business. And, you know, when we left TCW in 95, Bruce and I and the other founders, we were managing $7 billion at TCW. And the big question on our minds is, do you think we'll ever get back to $7 billion? And thanks to hopefully good performance, but also this increased interest in alternatives, you know, we're now at about 170 billion. So, you know, that was lucky too. And these were just some of the great events that produced the result that you see.
So a lot of being in the right place at the right time.
A lot. And by the way, I wrote I don't know if you've read it, Devin, but I wrote a memo in, I think, January of 14, as I recall, called Getting Lucky. And I reflect on the importance of luck and the fact that I believe I've been super lucky in my life. And I think that those of us who've been lucky should acknowledge it. And, you know, people who've been successful and don't attribute any of it to luck, I think, are insufferable. And I hope not to fall in that category.
Well, we're very lucky to have you here today. And something that you also mentioned was the meltdowns of the 2000 tech bubble. And that kind of leads me into another question I had, which is with regard to your book, The Most Important Thing. And there, within that book, you really had two conclusions that has really resonated with me. You stated that A, it's not about what you buy, it's about what you pay, and B, successful investing comes from buying well. I'm just kind of curious, in order to form those two conclusions, did you have any very memorable, very specific investments that helped cement those two kind of investment philosophies within you?
Well, Devin, that was a direct outgrowth of my early experience. And by the way, I define experience as what you got when you didn't get what you wanted. And most of your lessons, important lessons, are learned from your failures, not your successes. You don't learn much from success. You learn a lot from failure. And I would recommend to all of you, try to arrange it so that your failures come early, so that you learn early and you're better equipped for your career. My failure came because when I joined Citibank's equity research department in September of 69, the bank was an adherent to what was called Nifty 50 investing. That meant that the bank invested primarily in the stocks of the 50 best and fastest growing companies in America. These were companies that, number one, were so good that nothing could ever go wrong. And number two, they were so good that there was no price too high for the stocks. That was the official dictum in 1969. And if you went there when I did, and if you bought those stocks when I did, and you held them strongly, resolutely for the next 5 years, you lost almost all your money. You lost over 90% of your money. In the best companies in America. Why? Because half of these companies that where nothing was ever supposed to go wrong had something go wrong. And all of them had been overpriced. And they were selling at PE ratios, generally speaking, between 60 and 90. And 5 years later, PE ratios between 6 and 9. So that's the easy way to lose 90% of your money, which the bank did. So, you know, by 75, I was the bank's director of research. And, you know, I was associated with the failure that the Nifty 50 brought. And the head of the group wanted to replace me with his own head of research. And he asked me to start a convertible bond fund and move over to the bond department, which was Siberia in those days, and start a convertible bond fund. And then a high yield bond fund. And now I'm investing in some of the worst public companies in America, and I'm making money steadily and safely. So that was a clear lesson that success in investing does not come from buying good things, but from buying things well. And if you don't know the difference, you're in trouble. It's not a matter of just grammar. You know, remember, the official dictum of the Nifty 50 was that the price doesn't matter. And the answer is that price always matters, and it may be the thing that matters most. And there are very few, if any, assets that are so good that it doesn't matter what price you pay. They can't be overpriced. And there are very few that are so bad that they can't be cheap and worth buying. So value investing, which Emma says you practice at Limestone, is a matter of buying things at attractive prices. And so, you know, those were very, very important lessons that I fortunately learned in my first decade.
That's really great to hear. I think I definitely recall you mentioning about the Nifty 50 quite a few times in your memos.
Yeah, it's very, very important. It was a real object lesson.
Mm-hmm. I guess building off of that point, you mentioned that while you're at Citigroup, you kind of really fell into that trap of going with the herd and continuing with the Nifty 50. And that kind of reminds me of something that you mentioned in your memo, Dare to be Great Too. You mentioned the importance of taking on uncomfortably idiosyncratic positions. I'm kind of just curious, when did you kind of begin to form that opinion and form that realization that you cannot just continue with the herd in order to make outstanding results? But then once you actually moved to TCW, as well as during the early days of Oaktree, how did you bypass the quote unquote institutional considerations, especially with a lot of your reputation at risk when you're taking on these uncomfortable idiosyncratic positions?
Well, look, first of all, I let myself off the hook. You know, you should examine your mistakes, you should learn from them, but you shouldn't, castigate yourself forever. I let myself off the hook for falling into line with the Nifty 50 approach. I was a few weeks past my 23rd birthday when I started at Citi. And even when I became director of research, I was still in my 20s. I was in no position to say, oh, no, this is all wrong. You know, this is what the bank had done for many years, what everybody else thought was a good idea. So, you know, some 20-something year old is not going to come in and say, no, all you guys are screwed up. You're making a big mistake. Oh, I know better. So that was then. But, you know, as you learn, you understand, first of all, this matter of price versus value. Secondly, you take a more discriminating approach to the things that are going on around you. You spend your time figuring out what's wrong and what's right, and you reject the things that are wrong. And being asked to start the high yield bond fund was you know, one of the greatest moments in my life, because it brought me into contact with an asset class that most people thought was unseemly and disreputable and non-fiduciary, not responsible. And I had to convince people one by one to invest in high yield bonds. You know, Moody's at that time defined a B-rated bond as follows: fails to possess the characteristics of a desirable investment. In other words, it's a bad investment. You shouldn't do it. And, Devin, after this conversation, let's say you and I go downstairs and we meet on Wellington Street. And I have a car down there and I don't need it. And you need a car and you've got some money. And I ask you if you'll buy it. And hopefully, before you buy it, before you say, yes, I will, or no, hopefully you'll ask me a question. What's the question?
How much is that?
How much is it? Well, so Moody's was saying that B-rated bonds are a bad investment without asking the price. How can that be? And that reflects the naive approach to investing that prevailed until, you know, sometime in the mid-70s. And I learned that lesson and, had great success with the high yield bonds from overlevered, risky companies that paid a lot of interest and where the interest was sufficient to compensate for the risk. And so, you know, I learned the lesson of price versus value and the importance of being willing to do what other people won't do. So I was totally ready. And the more I did it, the more I was rewarded with success. And so, as you say, at TCW, we did it and we were among the few. And then with Bruce, we did distressed debt starting in 88 And then we carried that over to Oak Tree when we started up in 95. And, you know, it just really became second nature to us, I think, to be willing to do what other people aren't willing to do. And Dave Swenson made up that phrase, I didn't make it up, uncomfortably idiosyncratic. And, you know, those two words are, first of all, I think it's like poetry, those two words. And secondly, they encompass a huge percentage of what you have to think about. First of all, idiosyncratic, different from the herd. And, you know, I've written several memos and chapters in my books about the importance of behaving in a way which is idiosyncratic. And
absolutely. I think a major takeaway from that is really just making smart, but yet uncomfortably idiosyncratic decisions is a great philosophy for not only investing, but also for life in general.
Yes, but you know, you mentioned the most important thing, my first book. There was a second edition called the Illuminated Edition, the most important thing illuminated. And in that book, I and five other people include commentary on what is written there. So especially if you read it in Kindle, you read a paragraph, it talks about uncomfortably idiosyncratic, then there's a dot. And if you click on the dot, you get commentary from us. And my friend Joel Greenblatt, who was one of the great investors of all times, it said, you know, just on the subject of contrarianism, just because five other people declined to stand in the path of an oncoming truck doesn't mean you should. So you can't do things just because they're contrary. You have to figure out, what are other people doing? Why are they doing it? What's wrong with it? What do I think you should do? Why? What's the probability you're right? And so, you know, the knee-jerk reaction of doing the opposite of what other people are doing is not a good idea. But it's a good understanding what other people are doing and why it may be wrong, especially at moments when everybody else is doing the same thing, is a great starting point for making idiosyncratic and hopefully successful decisions.
I'd love to ask you more questions, but I have to hand you over to my co-panelist, Armand. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Devin.
Perfect. Thanks, Devin. And thank you again, Howard, for joining us today. So I just have a few questions about investing in the context of today's environment in particular. So during our analysis for us students, and I think professionals as well, we get caught in the trap of trying to sort of predict macroeconomic trends and how our investments will perform during these times. And you've talked extensively, especially in your memo, The Illusion of Knowledge, about how macroeconomic forecasting can be really futile. So to what degree do you think we should think about macroeconomics in our analysis? Is it more so, I guess, from the point of protecting our downside for potential harsher times in the economy? Or what do you think is the most important things we should consider in the context of the macroeconomic environment, especially because we're very unfamiliar with the environment we're going into based on the last 5-7 years in the economy for us?
You know, Armin, thank you for that question. There are two kinds of periods. There are periods when we feel uncomfortable because we don't know what lies ahead. And there are times when we feel comfortable because we think we have a good read on what lies ahead. And what I would submit to you is that the latter one is the mistake. We never know what lies ahead. And the belief that we know what lies ahead can be very misleading and dangerous. And so at Oak Tree, we acknowledge that we never know what lies ahead. And that's really important. And so we don't claim to know. And as you know, one of the six tenets of our investment philosophy is that we do not predicate our investments on macro forecasts. Armin kindly makes mention of the memo, The Illusion of Knowledge, which I think I wrote in October and which I thought was quite good. And the title comes from an American historian named Daniel Boorstin, who said that the enemy of ignorance is not, the enemy of knowledge is not ignorance, it's the illusion of knowledge. In other words, when people believe that they know something they don't know, it's misleading and dangerous. Mark Twain said, it ain't what you don't know that gets you into trouble. It's what you know for certain that just ain't true. And so I always stress the fact that in our industry, there is no room for certainty. And so what does that mean? How do we put that into work? So we never act on the assumption that we know what the future holds, and or that we have a forecast which is going to prove to be correct. If you do something in reliance on a macro forecast, and it turns out you're wrong, as Mark Twain says, that's how you get into trouble. If you say, I don't know what's going to happen in the future, it's harder to get into trouble. Now, the conundrum is, what is investing? And I'll ask you, Armin, or anybody else who wants to answer, what is, describe for me or define investing in one sentence.
I think investing to me is looking for opportunities for creating value, or finding value opportunities.
What are the last three words? In the future.
Yeah.
It's positioning your capital to benefit from future events. How can you do that without knowing or predicting what future events are going to be? That's the conundrum. And so most people I speak with say, well, you have to make forecasts. And I was visiting a friend of mine, an old friend who's a lifetime investor, the day that Illusion of Knowledge came out. So I gave it to him to read. And he says, but you have to take a position. And my point of view is you don't have to take a position. You can say, I don't know. And you can invest in a kind of a neutral expectation. What does this all mean in practice? I would say two things. We would never make an investment where the success is predicated on one form of macro future developing, materializing, because then it's just too easy to be wrong. And especially, we would never invest where you have, on the basis of optimistic assumptions, where that optimism has to be proved out in order to be successful, because it's too easy for it not to materialize. So we make the kind of neutral assumption about the future, like it mostly that the future will look like the past. And by the way, most of the time it does. Once in a while it doesn't, but there's not much you can do about that. So I would say humble expectations, modest expectations, and not situations where your success is hanging by a thread from one macro forecast. The way I break it down, I guess, is to say this. The macro, which is economics, markets, these things are very hard to predict. I think most people are better off not trying. You should spend all your time trying to, the way I say it, know the knowable. What's knowable? The little things, micro, not macro, micro. Companies, industries, securities. And if you study the micro and you work really hard, and hopefully you have some insight that other people don't have, you can get an advantage studying the micro. I don't think it's possible to get an advantage studying the macro. And you know what I said in that memo was, where are the famous macro investors? Who are the people who got famous and rich by predicting the course of the economy? Well, another way to say that is, where are the rich economists? Not that being rich is the measure of being smart or meritorious, but the point is, there are lots of people who've gotten rich picking stocks. Starting with Buffett, and Munger and maybe Peter Lynch at Fidelity and so forth. There aren't, I can name a couple of people who got rich as macro investors, but very few.
Absolutely. And I had one more question just on the topic of even stock picking. So one of the things you've talked about is sort of this misconception with what is actually considered mispricing opportunities. So in particular, you've sort of mentioned the trap of investors thinking low valuation parameters are synonymous to being underpriced. For a lot of us, especially as students, when we screen for investments, we're often using some sort of financial metric to narrow down to investments we want to look at. But this can actually lead to value traps, as you've mentioned. But on the other hand, if we start with companies we think are fundamentally sound, and then we might build out a valuation model with our assumptions, we might think the risk reward opportunity isn't favorable. So how would you suggest we think about our early stage investment process and screening?
You know, all these things, Armin, come down to judgment. And there's no, I can't write an algorithm for judgment. You can screen on quantitative factors, and PE ratio may be one of them. But you have to just take that as a starting point and then go on from there. But obviously, you would not expect to be successful if you started an investment management firm and you said, what we do is we buy the stocks with the lowest PEs, because the lowest PEs may be warranted for those stocks. They may be terrible stocks or terrible companies. And in fact, they may have the lowest PEs, and those PEs are too high because they're worth even less. So, you can screen on candidates for investigation, but you still have to do the investigation. And low prices and bargains are not synonymous. High prices or high PEs and overpriced are not synonymous, because some companies warrant high PE ratios. But for a value investor, one low PE could be one of the things you look at, but it wouldn't be a very good rule for an investment philosophy.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. And that's it for my section here. And I'm just going to pass it off to Tien to talk a little bit more about his questions as well.
Yeah, it's great to be talking to you. I'm sure everyone here is really thankful. And I just wanted to ask a little bit about some investing principles. And I know a lot of what you do is to be different from the market. And so, especially as students, how do you balance between humility and independent thinking? And you always have to question if the market knows something that you don't know, or if you don't know everything that you don't know. And so when we're competing against professionals, how should we balance this humility and the independent thinking?
Well, Tien, this is one of the great dilemmas in investing. If you don't have confidence, you can't do the right thing. You buy something because it's out of favor. If you buy things that are out of favor, you're more likely to get a bargain than if you buy the things that are in favor. So you buy something that's out of favor. That takes a certain amount of confidence. And then it goes down and you check your thesis. You think it's still intact, so you buy more. And of course, that takes confidence, because the market has said it's worth less. You say, no, it's not worth any less. I'm going to continue. So the price goes down, you still buy more. That takes confidence. You have to have superior insight. When I was preparing the most important thing for publication back in 2011, I believe it was, I had lunch with Charlie Munger, who worked in the building next door down here in downtown LA. And when I got up to go, he says to me, just remember, none of this is easy, and anybody who thinks it's easy is stupid. And that's a pretty good theme for your career. What we're talking about here is making money, and making more money than others. And everybody wants to make money. The competition is intense, and it involves other people who are maybe as smart as you, maybe as hardworking, maybe as thorough, etc. It can't be easy against stiff competition to be the one who makes the most money. And I'm using the term makes the most money as shorthand for outperforms. It's all about outperformance. But it can't be easy. And so you have to bear that in mind. You have to say, I'm not the only smart person in this business. Why does nobody else agree with me? Well, and just remember, sometimes they're right and sometimes you're right. You know, and back at University of Chicago 50 years ago, we used to tell the story about you're all familiar with the efficient market hypothesis? And we used to tell the story about the student and the finance professor are walking through the campus, and they're debating the merits of the efficient market hypothesis. Is it right or is it wrong? And it's heated. And they're walking along, and the student looks down, he points, and he says, Professor, isn't that a $5 bill lying on the ground there? And the professor says, no, it can't be a $5 bill, because if it was a $5 bill, somebody would have picked it up by now. And so he walks away in a huff, and the student picks it up and has a beer. The point is, markets are pretty efficient, but not perfectly efficient. And you shouldn't assume that the market knows everything, but you should not assume that the market knows nothing. And you have to balance that. And nobody can teach you how to balance it. It comes down to judgment, doesn't it? And it's the same in all these questions. Who's right? You hold a view which is different from the view of most others. Does that mean that you're wrong? No. Does that mean that you're right? No. I wrote a memo 20, 25 years ago called What's It All About Alpha? And you might read that memo. All the memos are online at www.oaktreecapital.com. And you might read that one. And it talks about the need to reconcile the efficient market hypothesis, which is a theory, with the real world. And if you ignore the concept of market efficiency, you're going to get into trouble. And if you absorb it wholesale, you can't go into this business. So you have to be somewhere in between. You have to understand it and look at it critically.
Right. And I think value investing, a big proposition of it is finding the opportunities within a almost, but not like perfectly, efficient market. And I know that value investing over the years has changed a lot from, you know, Graham to Fisher and then to Buffett and Munger. So what do you think value investing means to an investor, especially with a small sum of capital today?
First of all, I'll refer you to a memo. My son, who's a very good investor, and his family moved in with us at the beginning of the pandemic, March the 13th of 2020, and we all lived together for the next 3 months. And he and I had some spirited discussions on this topic, and I wrote it up in a memo called Something of Value, which most people, for most people, it's their favorite memo, and it was January of 21. Of course, they like it because of the personal aspect and the debates with Andrew that I describe in there. Here's a note from him. And so, you know, we talk in there a lot about value versus growth. What is value investing? I really think you should read it. And basically, value investing is buying shares as an interest in a business that you want to own for years. It's not necessarily about cheapness, although, you know, the essence of value investing is buying things for less than they're worth. But it's clearly not buying the cheapest things, because many times they're the worst things. But it's buying things where the price is low as a percentage of the intrinsic value. Historically, people have said, well, growth is buying things where the value is stable, Growth investing is buying things where the underlying value grows rapidly in the future. The memo argues against that dichotomy and against that bifurcation. And it says that the value investor should be willing to buy an interest in a company that has a bright future, which a lot of people identify with growth investing. So, one of the important elements of the memo is that the division between growth and value is somewhat artificial. And another is that you should be open-minded. And, you know, look, Buffett is always referred to as the greatest of the value investors at the present time, or maybe ever. And, you know, he's famous for not investing in tech. And he says, oh, Charlie and I put that on the too hard pile, too hard to understand. We're just simple people. We don't understand that. And yet he made a ton of money in Apple and probably the most money in Geico, which was a growth situation. He didn't buy it on a low percentage ratio of the current earnings exclusively. He thought that the earnings had a bright future, and they did. So the memo is about open-mindedness. And the worst thing, I think one of the worst things you can do in the investment business is to say, we do this, we don't do that. We do this, we don't do that. That implies we buy this at any price, we don't buy that, regardless of price. And that goes back to what I said at the beginning about the Nifty 50. And, you know, we buy stable companies and we don't buy growing companies. Why? So I really urge you to read that.
Yeah, I think for a long time, I think a lot of us has always kind of thought or even dreamed of starting maybe an investment fund, and especially with the freedom that comes with it. So what made you decide to start Oaktree? And what do people who want to start an investment fund need to know?
Well, I did it because I had put together a great group at TCW. We had worked together for on average 9 years, been very successful, both in terms of producing investment results, but also building a great clientele, and we enjoyed working with each other. And so we figured we could do it on our own. We could replicate the services that TCW was providing for us. If we continued to invest exactly the same and produce the same results, then we'd have a successful company. It was as simple as that. Now, what's unspoken there is that when you work for a firm, they take X percent of the revenues or X percent of the profits. And we concluded that the share of profits that they wanted was too big. Obviously, if the share of profits was too low, we should stay there. If it was just right, maybe we stay, maybe we go, but we thought they wanted too much. What happened is that when I started there in 85, my business was high yield bonds and convertibles. And we charged a management fee of 50%, 50 basis points. And roughly speaking, they got half and we got half. They provided the marketing, the premises, the accounting, the tax services. They took the risks. They provided the working capital, all those things. And we did the investing. And so we concluded that 50-50 was roughly fair. Then in 88, we went into this distressed debt business. Our first fund was $96 million fund. If we could double it, which I think we essentially did, and make a $96 million profit, and we get 20% of that, which is 19 million, how should that be divided? And they wanted half. And we said, but you didn't do anything to produce the 19 million of carried interest. And they drew the line at half. And that's probably the biggest immediate reason why we left. So that was economic. There were other reasons, which I won't go into. But, you know, in terms of the investment environment. But that's why we did it. And by the way, when we left, we were managing $7 billion. And the question was whether we would ever get back to 7 billion once we started Oaktree. And today we're at 170 billion. So that turned out to be a good risk to take. But that's what we did. Now your question, TN, was why do it?
So what should people looking to do that, what should we know?
Okay, well, look, number one, you have to conclude that you're going to be successful and that there's good reason to believe that. So obviously you can't do it on the basis of 1 year of good performance, because 1 year could be illusory. And have you read the book Fooled by Randomness? No.
I have not.
Okay, you should take a look at that book. Nassim Nicholas Taleb, Fooled by Randomness. And it talks about how random investment outcomes are. You know, you can make really good decisions and have bad performance. You can make really bad decisions and have good performance because of random factors and luck. And so clearly you shouldn't do anything based on 1 year's results or 2 years. But if you've invested for 9 years or 20 years and it's gone well, you can reasonably extrapolate, but not ironclad. So you have to have reason to believe that you can be successful based on a track record of some duration. The track record has to be compiled in periods which are welcoming to your approach and periods that are hostile to your approach. Because if you only do it based on results in good times and you run into bad times, you may have a big problem if your approach isn't suitable for that. Investing is one form of intellectual pursuit. But to start your own firm, you have to be entrepreneurial. And you have to be willing to put up capital for the desks and the premises and the registration expense and so forth. And you obviously, if you're like in anything else, if you're an entrepreneur as opposed to an employee, your highs are higher and your lows are lower. You have to be willing to live with that. You have to have some aggressiveness in your bones. That makes it appropriate for you to go out on your own. And, some people do it and some don't. There's got to be a reason.
Perfect. So that concludes the moderated portion of our Q&A. I know we're coming up on time, so we might be able to do one audience question. Chris Ma, do you want to ask the question?
Thank you very much, Emma. And I want to say thank you again for joining us today. Howard, it was really great hearing you speak. My question is, thank you very much. My question is, you talked earlier today about acknowledging efficiencies in the market. In your memo, Something of Value, which is definitely one of my favorites as well, you noted that public markets have dramatically changed over the years with a higher prevalence of accessible information and amount of individuals looking for bargains. How should fundamental investors such as myself and those on the call navigate a market that grows more quantitative and competitive, and that increasingly lacks information asymmetry, and take advantage of, as you say, opportunity for dramatic changes in businesses?
Well, that's a good question, except that I will take issue with one of your premises, Chris, because you say the market has become more quantitative. And I believe that the more quantitative the market becomes, the more scope there is to be superior by being more qualitative. And in the memo, Something of Value, which apparently you read, Andrew makes the point, which I thought was a really good point, and he makes things beautifully, that readily available quantitative information regarding the present cannot be the source of superior performance. Why? Because everybody has it. In order to have superior performance, you have to have something everybody else doesn't have. And quantitative information is something that everybody has. The SEC views a big part of its job as making sure everybody has the same information at the same time. So if that's the case, how can you outperform? And the answer is, you have to have something everybody else doesn't have. And that's unlikely to be readily available quantitative information about the present. So what can it be? It could be doing a better job of interpreting the significance of that quantitative information. It can be a better job of assessing the qualitative factors, like the quality of management and the quality of the product pipeline and things like that, or a better job of assessing the future, which is by definition qualitative because it doesn't exist. You can't quantify the future or analyze it or break it down. So you have to do, that's where your edge has to come from. And so this highlights even more the importance of insight. You know, I say in the memo, remember I tell the story about Buffett going around buying things from farmers on their front porch. And Buffett himself used to say that he bought dollars for 50 cents. And that assumes that the people you're buying from are stupid. Today, the world is better informed. Data is more ubiquitous. Computers, everybody's got one. Data feeds and so forth. And so it's harder to buy dollars for 50 cents because there aren't that many stupid people around anymore. And if you find a dollar that you can buy for 50 cents, you think, then somebody's likely to show up and say, I'll pay 60. Because wouldn't you pay 60 cents for a dollar? And maybe somebody else says, I'll buy 70. And that's what happens in an efficient market. And that's what causes price to converge with value. So you have to understand that. You have to find something others don't have. The easiest place for that to reside is in superior insight, superior judgment. So, I mentioned what Charlie said about anybody who thinks it's easy and stupid. I wrote a memo. I think it was September of 15, but I'm not sure. 14, 15, something like that. And it's called It's Not Easy. And that's what you have to bear in mind. And you know, investment can provide a wonderful, intellectually stimulating, dynamic career, and maybe even lucrative, but it can't be easy because all the other people want to get rich too. So how can it possibly be easy to be the one who does? And by the way, not everybody can get rich. If some people do above average, others have to do below by definition. And so since you're competing against other people who are intelligent, hardworking, numerate, computerized, et cetera, highly motivated, how can it be? It can't be easy to be the one who ends up with more. And you have to accept that, and you have to work really hard, and you have to have an edge, and you have to have superior judgment, and you have to get lucky.
I think with that, Howard, we can wrap things up here. I just want to say, as someone who's been an avid reader of your material for a while, this has been an absolutely incredible opportunity to hear your insights and your perspectives in person. So I wanted to thank you on not only behalf of Limestone Capital, but on behalf of Queen's University as well, for you taking the time to speak with us students. This has been a very incredible opportunity. And I could say for myself, as well as the rest of the crowd, we have learned a lot through this 1 hour call.
Well, it's my pleasure, Devin. I enjoyed speaking with you. You all had good questions. I'll be up in Toronto in a few weeks. Let me look it up, and maybe we can visit again then. Let's see. There's an event coming up. Let's see when it is. April 19th. There's something called the Value Investing Conference at the Delta Hotels. So if you haven't had enough, you can get more then. Thank you for inviting me today, and I enjoyed it. I've given you lots to read. Thanks, everybody.
Perfect. Thanks, Howard.
Thank you. Yeah.